Committee members, we're going to call the meeting to order. We got a lot of people going in and out from various committee meetings, and so we're going to try to stick as much to schedule. We're setting 5 minutes late, but we'll get it going here. We have 3 bills on the agenda today, and I do want to take some time and talk to people about the targets that we've got, and we'll do that at the end of the meeting. So since Representative Kranz has to be going to another committee, I'm going to ask Representative Shumpert to chair. And
our first bill then is by Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to move House Bill 2100 be recommended to pass, and at this point be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay.
And members, I do have a couple of witnesses that I would like to have introduce and provide some comments. Basically, what we're doing in this bill is phasing out several hormone disrupting chemicals that now are present in many of our children's products. And what we want to do in this bill is give them a time certain when they can no longer be manufactured for sale here in Minnesota. And the two chemicals are bisphenol A and phthalates. And I'm going to, the bill is pretty straightforward. It gives the dates on the different parts of the bill when those two chemicals will be phased out, and it talks about the fact that replacement chemicals can have to be safe alternatives. And it does also allow us to participate in the interstate clearinghouse.
Representative Clark, I'll call the meeting to order since we now have a quorum.
Thank you very much.
Sorry about that.
Okay. I'd first like to provide some testimony from Dr. David Willendis.
Dr. Willendis, could you identify yourself?
Yeah, I'm David Wallinga. I'm a physician, homegrown. I trained at the University of Minnesota here. And among other things, I serve on the Board of Scientific Counselors for the Centers for Disease Control, National Center for Environmental Health. I did just want to spend a few minutes reviewing some of the things that I think are salient about what we know about these chemical classes, bisphenol A and phthalates, which is actually a class of different chemicals, which are, we know from the science, disrupt hormone function. Bisphenol A, since 1936, has been known to disrupt reproductive function. It's a synthetic estrogen. Phthalates are more anti-androgens, androgens being hormones like testosterone, but they also affect other hormones like follicle-stimulating hormone, luteinizing hormone. These are mainly hormones involved in the female reproduction, and thyroid hormone, which you all recognize. So we know that. We also know that we're all widely exposed to these two classes of chemicals, and we know that from Centers for Disease Control data. And we also know it from recent studies. For example, this one listed in pediatrics from this year looked at infants, tested infants, more than 160 of them, and found that 80% of them had 7 or more phthalates in their urine, and these were infants 3 months of age or younger. So we know that. So actually, there's not much debate around the number of scientific things that I'm going to be talking about. We know hormones are very important, even at very, very, very low doses, because that's how they operate in the body. And in fact, when we do preclinical testing of pharmaceuticals that are intended to go in the market, they're often tested on animals. And so we know what an effective dose is of things like hormones and birth control pills. And the effective dose for one birth control pill, for example, is 30 parts per trillion. So that's an exquisitely low level of hormones. Another thing we know is that hormones work in a huge range of ways in the body, all the way from fetal development up into adulthood, across a huge range of organ systems, when the brain develops, thyroid, metabolism, weight control, fertility. Hormones are even involved now, we know, in programming genes to turn on or off even decades later in life. And so you can't just look at one endpoint when you're thinking about hormones or hormone disruption. You know, for example, hypophagias or falling sperm counts. You got to look at the whole range of different things that hormones do. And finally, we know that there's now hundreds of different studies for both phthalates and bisphenol A showing that they in fact do disrupt hormone function in animal and human studies, and that these effects occur in the case of bisphenol A, for example, down to 0.2 parts per trillion. And in fact, we depend on animal studies, as I said, to test for potential human harm in pharmaceuticals, and we pay attention to animal studies around our concerns for environmental chemicals, too. So another thing there's very little debate over in terms of the science is that there is some risk from using these hormone-disrupting chemicals in products. We may not be able to give you a number in terms of what the risk is, but in this NIH, National Institutes of Health-sponsored expert panel from November 2006, for example, their conclusion was that there is a great cause for concern from these animal studies in bisphenol A with regard to their potential for causing adverse effects in humans that are similar or just like the effects they see in animals. So there is some concern, we know that. I'm not going to belabor all these different scientific studies on bisphenol A, but just to point out to you that what we see is studies across a whole range of different endpoints, whether it's cancer, reproduction, fertility, brain, obesity, and that's because hormones operate across all these different spheres. So when you're looking at a synthetic estrogen that can disrupt hormone function, you've got to think broadly. I wanted to just point out to you this article in Scientific American, and Doubt is Their Product, pointing out that there's a history around environmental chemicals, including tobacco, of sort of manufactured uncertainty around the science. And in front of this body just a decade ago, Philip Morris was saying that they were unclear whether cigarettes caused smoking-related disease. So there's this issue of what's proof, what's cause. And of course, the funding of the studies is very important. University of Missouri looked at 170 different studies on bisphenol A, looking at very, very low-level exposures in animals. And they found the government studies overwhelmingly showed adverse effects from these exposures. The industry-funded studies, none of them showed adverse effects. Of course, there's many more government studies than there are industry studies. So one of the lessons, I think, from this brief history is that one should be wary of falling for this argument that there's no proven cause of a single environmental chemical causing a single health outcome, especially for hormone disruption, because there is such a wide range of functions in the body that hormones are involved in. And in fact, in these studies, what we see with respect to exposure to these chemicals is going to depend very much on the timing of the exposure, whether it's a very young animal or an adult animal, and even whether it's in the first week of pregnancy or the last week. That's going to determine the whole range of things that we see in these studies. And so it's not just about whether bisphenol A exposure has been proven to cause a particular endpoint like hypophagias. It's rather about the whole range of science, hundreds of studies showing hormone disruption across a range of different organs. And then finally, you're not going to find a smoking gun in the science for the same reason. And that's because any of these chronic diseases that we're concerned about, whether it's fertility or obesity or cancer, none of them have a single cause. What we know now is that chronic diseases, unlike infectious diseases, have multiple causes. And often it's the interaction of things the interaction of genes plus chemicals plus diet plus other factors that cause these diseases. So to pretend like we're going to be able to tease out the contribution of one chemical, it's very difficult to do. But that's not to negate all the hundreds of studies that we do have showing or suggesting that these chemical exposures, in fact, do contribute to a whole range of things that we know are very prevalent now or on the rise. And I'm talking about breast cancer, prostate cancer, obesity, diabetes, metabolic syndrome, and learning disabilities like ADHD. And for some reason. So, given the certain risk of putting these hormone-disrupting chemical glasses in products, given that we think there might be harm in the human population, but it's very, very difficult to say how great that harm is, given that there's ready alternatives available, and we know that, the question is not really scientific, it's about policy. And with that, I just want to end my comments. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Willinger. Any questions for Dr. Willinger? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Swell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about, I have heard that the European Union has been able to create these products without these particular chemicals in them, that they have been able to produce that on a large scale. What is prohibiting the U.S. from adopting the same standards that the European Union has?
Dr. Wellinger? Or, go ahead, the other.
I can answer that question. My name is Lindsay Allen. I'm the coordinator for Healthy Legacy.
Okay.
That's a really good question. Phthalates are banned in the European Union in addition to 14 other countries, including Fiji, Argentina, Mexico, and recently the state of California, as of this past October. And what's preventing the United States from having those same regulations is the federal government, as we saw this past holiday season, is really failing to step up to the plate and protect children and children's toys. And so that's where the Minnesota legislature has a unique opportunity to really step up, where the federal government has fallen behind, specifically look at eliminating these chemicals. I would just also like to note that since California passed their phthalate ban in October of 2007, manufacturers are reconfiguring to make those same products that they have in the European Union for the state of California. So what this piece of legislation would do would really just add to that momentum.
Ms. Bell, did you want to testify? Were you planning on testifying? Maybe that would be good to do that before we added. Go ahead, if you would like. We're going to try to have each side testify about 15 minutes here, so we stay on schedule with our...
I have a question just at that point.
Just certainly.
Point of last question.
Representative.
The question that I heard was, where are these chemicals banned? And I heard you respond to phthalates, but what about bisphenol A? I mean, I guess where have they been banned, and is there a similar kind of a trend going on in that field?
Ms. Dallas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a similar trend, but with bisphenol A, it's newer than it is with phthalates. So bisphenol A hasn't been banned in the European Union or any place. But what we found is that this past summer, there's a scientific consensus statement that really added to the momentum of states working on bisphenol A. So currently there's 11 other states that are working on bisphenol A based on this August 2007 Chapel Hill consensus statement.
Ms. Bell, if you want to go ahead and testify, that'll maybe sure. answer some questions that people may have.
Sure. I just want to, I'll keep my comments brief for the interest of time, but my name is Lindsay Dahl, and I coordinate Healthy Legacy. We're a statewide public health coalition that is working to eliminate toxic chemicals from our everyday products. And I would just like to say that the public support for this bill is absolutely overwhelming. Healthy Legacy currently has 26 member organizations that come from a range of different groups, and it's really the first time that groups like the Parent Teacher Association, Clean Water Action, the Minnesota Council of Churches, different groups are coming together to talk about addressing toxic chemicals in everyday products. And in fact, even this morning I received a fax from the Minnesota Association for Children's Mental Health requesting to be a part of Healthy Legacy. So the public support is really overwhelming. The calls are flooding into our offices. And people just really want their products to be safe and tested before they hit the shelves. They want to be able to go to the store and find products know that all the products are safe. And I just think the essence of this bill can really be wrapped up in these two baby bottles. And I also have rubber duckies that can be, can show the same for phthalates. But these two baby bottles are actually the same brand. Neither of them have numbers on the bottom, so I have labeled them because we had to do a little research project to find out what numbers they are. But this one is made out of polycarbonate plastic, so it contains bisphenol A. This one does not. It's number 4. So this is a safer plastic. Parents can't, they just didn't have to be chemists to be able to find a safe baby bottle. This is actually a cheaper baby bottle than the unsafe polycarbonate bottle. And what Minnesotans are just really asking is to be able to go into the store and know that no matter what the bottle looks like, no matter what the cost, that it's safe and it doesn't contain hormone disrupting chemicals.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, testify. Well, I'll just to whoever wants to answer this one. I guess the question I've got here is, I know just in follow-on with what Representative Eastland was speaking to, was the phthalates we know are a problem. Mm-hmm. But the bisphenol A is currently, as testified here, has been going through a bunch of studies, and as was spoken to up here, basically saying there's no real solid way to get any science. You said yourself that this is so early in the stage. How do we know how it affects? Well, let me finish. I'm just curious as to why we're bunching these together. The phthalates we know are problematic. Why not just separate the phthalates out and say, okay, let's do a study on the bisphenol A and determine whether it's got the same effects as the other? I think when you talk about all of the coalitions or the groups that have come in behind you on this particular issue, I agree wholeheartedly, but they're basing their support on solid science. They're saying, if you as an organization have done your scientific work, then we're behind you all the way. And I don't think that's what's happened here with the bisphenol A. That's my take on this right now, so maybe you could respond to that.
Doctor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson. I'll respond to the scientific piece as I see it. There are a couple of reasons why to lump these things, and let me just say first off that I think there are hundreds of studies of bisphenol A, so the science is quite voluminous. And the consensus statement from Chapel Hill, which actually came out of a November 6 conference I mentioned in my points, and it found great cause for concern in humans. There was another conference, NIH-sponsored conference that reported out in August, and they also found cause for concern in terms of effects on the developing brain. So there's a lot of consensus around the science and cause for concern. So why lump them together? Because they're both compounds, chemical classes that disrupt hormones, and that is what makes them similar. They might work on different hormones in different organs, but they're both similar in that they're disrupting functions of the body that are dependent upon hormones from fetal development all the way up through adulthood. The second thing is that they're both found in products that are that create risks for a particular class of us as human beings, and that's our children and our very youngest and most vulnerable. And they're vulnerable precisely because they depend on hormones to guide their development at the same time that they're being exposed to these chemicals in their products, the baby bottles or their teething toys or things like that. So that's why I think there's a good rationale for why to look at them together.
Ms. Bell, did you want to respond?
That's pretty much what I was going to say. I just want to follow up and also say another reason to look at these two chemicals together is because there are two chemicals where there's already safer products that are on the market.
Okay. And just
Stevenson, go ahead.
Chair. And I guess I understand from what you're saying is there are compelling, that you're always putting in the condition that there's compelling evidence. You know, when we were discussing the smoking ban issue, it was pretty hard to get that through until we had the Surgeon General's report that said, hey, this is no kidding, documented through fields of scientists. And if that was the compelling evidence that we had before us, I'd say we may have something going here. Maybe what you wanted speak to is whether the Surgeon General has addressed this issue or not.
Well, thank you, Mr.
Go ahead,
Representative Stevenson. The point I would make instead is that the Surgeon General's report came out in the 1960s, and yet the Philip Morris CEO is here in 1998 saying that there's no proof that smoking causes illness. So it's that three-decade time lag between where the science is and where there's compelling evidence in the eyes of the industry that is getting sales from their product that concerns me. And in this case, I think there is compelling evidence, just like there was for tobacco, around the potential for human harm. The other thing to note, though, is just the conception of science. Science is virtually never going to be certain. If we knew exactly what the science was going to say across the whole range of issues, we wouldn't need legislators. We would just know what to do and there wouldn't be any questions. So it's never going to be completely certain, but what we do have is hundreds of studies with consistent results, at least the government-funded studies, with consistent results indicating grave cause for concern, in the words of the expert panels convened by NIH.
In order to accommodate opponents of this legislation, I'd like to move on to their testimony now, and if you will be available, and if we have time, we'll have additional questions. So is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify against this legislation? Welcome.
Thank
just
you,
identify
Chairman.
Yourself
yes,
for the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Stephen Henches. Sorry, am I loud enough?
I think that's
Dr.
Good.
Stephen Henches, and I'm here representing the manufacturers of polycarbonate plastic and bisphenol A. Although I don't live in the state now, my roots are here. I was born and raised in Minnesota, and am also a graduate of the University of Minnesota. I'm here today to talk about bisphenol A. I think you've understood that bisphenol A is completely different from phthalates. These are two different materials used in completely different ways. Bisphenol A is used primarily to make two things. It's used to make polycarbonate plastics, such as used to make baby bottles, and it's also used to make epoxy resins, which are widely used, for example, as the coatings that protect the integrity and safety of canned foods and beverages. Both polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins are very widely used in a vast array of consumer products, many of which are used or intended for use by infants and children. I want to get, though, to my bottom line, though, and I think you heard this before in response to a question. Bisphenol A is not banned or restricted anywhere in the world, and here's why. There is an extraordinarily rich scientific database that supports the safety of bisphenol A. That science has been reviewed repeatedly and comprehensively by many independent scientific and government bodies around the world. All of these independent reviews support the conclusion that bisphenol A and consumer products containing bisphenol A are safe for use. For example, going back to 2001, a review by the National Toxicology Program, the U.S. National Toxicology Program. In 2002 and 2003, three separate reviews came out of the European Union. In 2005, reviews from the Japanese Ministry of the Environment and also a review from the Japanese National Institute of Advanced Industrial Science and Technology. That's Japan's largest public research organization, which is affiliated with the Japanese Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry. In 2007, the European Food Safety Authority issued their review on bisphenol A. And this year already, two more reviews have come out, or actually one has come out, one will come out very soon. Just released was a comprehensive review from NSF International, which is a nonprofit public health organization based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. That review was actually led by a scientist from the California EPA. And soon to be issued is yet another comprehensive review from the European Union. It's actually finished. We know what it says. We're just awaiting the final publication of it. All of these reviews support the conclusion that bisphenol A is not a risk to human health, including the health of infants and children. And indeed, based on these reviews, bisphenol A is not banned or restricted anywhere in the world. Products such as polycarbonate baby bottles or canned infant formula are accepted as safe for use and indeed are used around the world. So you've heard about concern about bisphenol A. Yes, some people are concerned about bisphenol A, but concern is not the same thing as risk. And indeed, if there is a consensus on the safety of bisphenol A, as I just described, based on many different reviews around the world, the consensus is that these products are safe for use. couple more things I want to mention in regard to specific products. You've heard a lot about baby bottles. You've probably all seen things in the media about toxic baby bottles, that sort of thing. But what you're not seeing in the media are the results of recent studies that have been conducted by other authoritative bodies around the world. For example, at the end of last year, the Norwegian Food Safety Authority issued their report. They actually did testing on polycarbonate baby bottles to try to determine, could those bottles become unsafe under real-life use conditions? They concluded not. Another report came from the researchers at the University of Athens in Greece. They were looking at other conditions of use, different ways of cleaning the bottles, heating the bottles, and so on. Same bottom line conclusion. They could not find any real-life conditions of use that would lead to a harmful product. Another study just coming out now from TNO, which is a well-respected Dutch research institute looking at microwaving polycarbonate bottles. Same conclusion. Could not find any reason for concern. So when you look fully at all of the science, I think what you will find is what the government bodies and independent scientific bodies around the world have found, which is that these products are safe for use. And finally, one last thing on alternatives. There is this view that we should use safer alternatives. It's a very common sense view, and who could argue with that? But the question is, what are safer alternatives, and how do you know? Indeed, bisphenol A is one of the most studied substances on Earth. There are no alternatives that have been tested so thoroughly, no alternatives that have been vetted so carefully by government bodies. You will not find anything with the certainty of safety as you will with bisphenol A and polycarbonate products. So, in summary, I'm here to oppose the bill. I think you figured that out. And the reason is that it is not, for bisphenol A, it is not supported by the science. Indeed, the science really supports the opposite conclusion. All of these scientific reviews that I've cited all affirmatively support the safety of products made from bisphenol A. So with that, I'll stop and either take questions now or you could go on with testimony as you wish.
Thank you, Doctor. Usually when people come in and cite a lot of studies, they have some along. Do you have any of these studies along that you've cited?
Do I have them with me?
Yes, copies.
Well, no, I don't have copies because I had to travel here, and the copies are total, couple reams of paper.
Well,
I can get them to you.
I certainly would like a copy of anything.
Absolutely.
So I think Representative Benson had a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Hinchins, there was a discussion by the previous presenters here over the issue of gout having to do with cigarettes and all the other issues. In your professional opinion, is there any doubt at all in your mind about the safety of this particular product?
Well, I'll go back to a comment that was made earlier about what science can and cannot do. Science has great difficulty with coming to conclusions with absolute certainty. But you're asking for my personal opinion,
yes.
I think. I'm just one person, and I've told you about what a lot of other people think, but me as one person, I have no reservations about using products made from polycarbonate plastic or epoxy resins.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative
Bennett. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Dr. Hinchins, let's assume that you do not have any personal doubt. Do you think it's good policy for you to oppose others who do have doubt and who have difficulty finding alternative products they feel would be safer?
Well, I don't think it is good public policy to proceed on the path you're going, which is to ban products that have a long track record of safe use, about 50 years, which have a very large scientific database that supports them, and that science has been reviewed and by many government bodies around the world. To the extent that there is a consensus on bisphenol A, yes, there is concern among some, but to the extent there is a consensus, that consensus is that these products are safe for use.
Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, would you support clear labeling of products which have this ingredient in it versus those that do not?
Doctor? Go ahead.
I would say that manufacturers have the option now to label their products what it is or isn't.
I didn't ask that. I asked, do you support clear labeling so that consumers can identify which product is on the shelf and they have a choice? Not knowing which product it is does not give people a choice. Does the organization you represent support clear labeling of these products?
I don't think we would support labeling of the way that you described, because that would not provide adequate information for a consumer to understand what one product is versus another. An unlabeled product is made out of a chemical. And without information, how is the consumer really able to evaluate?
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to pursue this too much, but I don't understand why you would be in opposition, since the product, in your view, is safe. Let's assume these consumers are really ignorant, and they have been misled by others, that the science that you quote is absolutely solid, as solid as science can be. What is the harm in allowing people to select a product which does not have your ingredient in it? I don't understand. Is it a big expense problem? What is it?
No. It has nothing to do with expense. It has to do with misinformation. Only having certain products labeled as whether they do contain bisphenol A only provides partial information. It doesn't tell you anything about the other products. Manufacturers do have the ability now, manufacturers of alternatives do have the ability now to label their products as not containing bisphenol A. They can do that with WIC. That, I think, is a better alternative.
I'm sorry, this one, if you would indulge me.
Final question.
Yeah, thank you. What would be the problem or the difficulty for a company which includes this chemical in its products from labeling it as such, so that those who agree with you can rush to the shelves and buy those products in opposition to others that may or may not be as harmful?
Okay.
I just think you've got a problem here with this issue, that you choose not to label, even if we are not moving to ban the product. What's wrong with the public having full disclosure and knowledge about these products?
I think it would be misinformation, because it does not provide complete information. If the alternative products were to be labeled with what comes out of them, what are they made out of, what leaches out of them, maybe that would be a fair playing field. But as I pointed out, the alternative, you're not going to find any alternative that's been tested so well as bisphenol A.
Well, you would be in favor, then, of allowing labeling both of the products that you support and those that are not.
And again, manufacturers do have the ability now to label their products as free.
Yeah, I know.
Are you there?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Benson. We'll take one question from Representative Morgan, and then we'll hear from the other witness.
Mr. Chair, if it's okay with you, I might have a couple of questions. If you'd rather hear from the other witness first,
yes,
that would be great.
Let's hear from the other witness. We want to kind of stay on timeline here. Go ahead. Identify yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Easter, and I'm the Midwest Director of State Government Affairs for the American Chemistry Council. And in light of the lateness of the hour and the agenda you have, I will be very brief. I just want to make 2 points. That a recent statement by the Consumer Product Safety Commission with regard to alternatives stated that there is no demonstrated health risk posed by PVC toys or other products intended for children 5 years of age or younger. If BINT is to be replaced in children's products, whether on a mandatory or voluntary basis, the potential risks of the substitute must be considered. Weaker or more brittle plastics might break and result in a choking hazard. Other plasticizers might not be as well studied as BINT. And so when we're talking about alternatives, the track record of testing should be sufficient, or if it's currently on other alternatives, not as sufficient as what is currently in place on BINT. The second point I want to make is this. California passed the ban on phthalates. Minnesota is looking at this in this legislation. There are differences between the two, and what we would support is resolving this issue at the federal level and harmonizing the policy. And so with that, I'll conclude.
Okay. Thank you. Before we take additional questions, is there anyone else here who wants to testify against the bill? I'm concerned about time. Okay. Representative Morgan, I think you had a question or two.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, for Dr. Hentges. Dr. Hentges, you mentioned in your testimony some reviews of, I don't know if they were scientific studies themselves or reviews of scientific studies that indicated that bisphenol A is completely safe. Were those indeed scientific studies you were quoting? If so, were they published in scientific journals and subject to peer review, or were they reviews of the literature that was out there on studies about EPA?
Doctor, go ahead.
To go back, there are hundreds, probably thousands of individual studies, and by that I mean laboratory studies on bisphenol A. What the ones that I cited were not those individual studies, but rather reviews or comprehensive evaluations of the weight of evidence, of all of that evidence that's available. And depending on where they come from, for example, the NSF International one, that is published in a peer-reviewed journal. Government evaluations, they're done in different ways, but they're all published, they're all available. But the process by which those are developed, it depends on the government body, how that actually is done. But they're all publicly available. Often there is a very open and transparent public process.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Hench, is this hopefully a quick answer to this one? Are you a medical doctor, sir?
No, I'm a scientist by training. My degree is in chemistry, and I've spent most of my career in health and environmental activity.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Morgan.
I was hoping you were a medical doctor, sir, but perhaps you can provide an expert opinion of this based on your experience in the chemical field. Do you understand that there is a great deal of scientific evidence to support the fact that endocrine disruptors are very, very harmful to human growth and development and health, and can cause chronic diseases? Are you aware of that, or do you accept that as a scientific consensus?
Doctor?
What I would say is that there is the concept of endocrine disruption or endocrine disruptors doesn't tell you that something is harmful to human health. It tells you that there is the potential for harm. And that's the reason why there are now hundreds, really even thousands of laboratory studies to test and determine whether there actually is harm. And based on all of those studies, that's what the reviews look at, these comprehensive evaluations conducted by government bodies, is looking at that weight of evidence to draw a conclusion, to assess those studies and draw a conclusion, is there actually harm or potential for harm or not? And those reviews have reached the conclusion that there is little or no risk to human health from bisphenol A. That conclusion cannot be extended to all chemicals. That's very focused on just the one.
Representative Morgan.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Hentges, well, thank you for testifying that endocrine disruptors can cause harm in these cases. My next question is, are you aware of, or do you understand that bisphenol A is indeed an endocrine disruptor? And are you aware of, you state reviews of studies that say there is no problem? Are you aware of the studies out there that say that there is great cause for concern? We've heard testimony this morning, and I'm going to ask, my last question will be to ask other testifiers who testified previously to come up and respond to your claims. But are you aware of the testimony and the studies that have said, yes, indeed, there's great cause for concern about this bisphenol A, and though the science is not proving anything, which science really is not designed to do, that it certainly is representing a great deal of evidence that we have cause for concern, particularly amongst our most fragile and vulnerable members of our society, our children.
Doctor?
Yes, I think I noted earlier that there are some who have concerns, but again, concern does not equal risk. And indeed, the view that there are concerns, I believe that is a minority view, and the evidence for that is the many reviews, the many comprehensive reviews conducted around the world, U.S., Europe, and Japan over the years, very consistently reaching the conclusion that bisphenol A is not a risk to human health. So while some may be concerned, and I acknowledge that concern, the evidence, the weight of the scientific evidence, does not demonstrate a risk to human health.
Representative Morgan, do you have a question?
I think perhaps I'm not making my point clearly enough, and maybe it would help if I could call up as perhaps some rebuttal testimony from Dr. Wallinga.
We can do that for one more question, then we'll have to wrap it up soon. Dr. Wallinga, I think Representative Morgan had a question for you yet, or did other committee members have questions for either of these two witnesses? Okay. Oh. Representative Morgan, you had a question yet for
Thank
Dr. Wallinga?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Wallinga, I'm having a hard time stating this the way I ought to. I only have a bachelor's degree in a scientific field and not as well trained, perhaps, in it the way that you are. I would like to hear your comments about the previous testifier's claims of reviews and studies and evidence and consensus and so forth. What is your response to his claims?
Doctor?
Go ahead. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, you know, the nice thing about science is that it progresses over time. And so we tend to learn more. We don't learn less. And so when I was talking about the two most recent NIH-sponsored panels, that resulting in the Chapel Hill Consensus Statement, November 2006, and the one of August 2007, I was focusing on those that are recent. I think that the science is moving incredibly fast in this field. That's not to say that there isn't a lot of science now. It's just to say that a lot of it's come very quickly. And so there might very well have been reviews in 2001 that are not nearly as relevant now as they were then. So that's why I focused in my comments on those two most recent ones. And I agree with their characterization that they did, in fact, in their own words, say there is great cause for concern about these consistent hormone disruption findings in animals also occurring in humans, particularly given the range of consistent health problems that we're seeing in humans. The other thing I'd point to, and the members of the panel have this, we just summarized some of the studies, the recent studies, generally from 2007, 2005, 2006, confirming the low-dose toxicity of bisphenol A across a whole range of hormone-related effects, and I would just submit that for your consideration. The other thing I want to talk about briefly is that you know, my comments are directed towards the chemical additive to polycarbonate plastic, bisphenol A, and all the science that suggests that we ought to be worried about that. I know, in fact, that there are now manufacturers making polycarbonate plastic without bisphenol A. You can make it, and maybe they should make it without bisphenol A, and those polycarbonate products could very well be safer. Because they don't have this synthetic estrogen in them. So, for example, Camelback, which makes those water bladders that people carry for outdoor sports, they've just come out with a product line of polycarbonate products that don't have the bisphenol A in them. So I think it's good that we be clear about safety of bisphenol A versus safety of polycarbonate plastic, and depending on what question you give to an expert panel, they might come out with very different answers to that question. You know, is polycarbonate safe versus is bisphenol A safe?
Thank you for making that distinction. Representative McFarland, I believe you have a question.
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. This is for Representative Clark. I'm just wondering, if this were to become law, what agency or department would be overseeing the sale of these items to see if anybody's enforcing it or overseeing it?
Well, that's a good question. We have had this bill go through the Commerce Committee, through the Health Committee, and now through the Public Health Committee. And we don't have an actual enforcement mechanism in here at this point. We think that, you know, banning it will take care of it as it has in California. And, you know, I guess we're not giving anybody enforcement powers beyond the fact that the law will be on the books. And then we'll see if there's any need for that.
Dr. Representative McFarland?
Yeah, and then I just had one other question about Section 5. When you it refers to the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, may participate in the establishment. Have they been contacted about being a part of this?
Representative Clark?
Yes, this is permissive, and the clearinghouse is being established as an assistant.
Okay.
That's why they may.
I think but Dr. Hentges, did you have something you wanted to comment? I noticed I think we'll wrap it up then. Representative Clark, I can't recall. What's your motion?
I mean, my motion is that the bill be made over for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay. And I don't believe we have to vote on it, do we? Or do we vote on that?
You just need to affirm that it's made over.
Okay. Then the motion is laid over for possible inclusion into, or the bill is laid over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Okay.
Thank you.
Any And let's see, our next bill is House File 3199 by Representative Loeffler. Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Let's see. Representative Loeffler, do you know where we want to go with this bill?
Mr. Chairman, members, I would recommend it go to the General Register. We, Dwayne Elg isn't in the audience here from the Department of Human Services, but I understand he has testified in the Senate that there's no fiscal impact to this, even though we don't have an official fiscal note yet. And the Senate has similarly considered it. Madam Chair, should I describe the bill?
Please, go ahead and begin. Did we move the bill?
The question was about the referral, and I had suggested the General Register.
Representative Benson, do you want to move this bill? We just need a motion the bill for passage.
Thank you. I was concerned about Representative Morgan leaving me here, so I'm sorry. I move 3191 for possible inclusion.
Actually, this will be to be passed and returned to finance.
Oh, passed and be returned to finance.
There we go. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill deals with our continuing effort to move people to the least restrictive environment. Particularly people with disabilities who are under age 65. Current law has a program that you probably have heard about in other discussions known as Minnesota Supplemental Assistance Shelter Needy. And it allows for an additional cash supplement for someone who is moving into community living whose allocation would not meet current rental costs. And it's available currently to people who move out of regional treatment centers, nursing homes, and long-term care or intermediate care facilities for people with mental retardation. And this bill would extend that to people moving out of corporate foster care. If you're not familiar with corporate foster care, it's just staff as opposed to the family model that many people think of when you say foster care. It's actually a small living situation, but there is 24-hour staffing and supervision. We have a wide variety of individuals who are ready to move into a much more independent situation, living in an apartment with someone who's checking in on them periodically, but who don't, who no longer require 24-hour supervision. This will enable us to cost-effectively move them out. If you can't pay the rent, you can't move someone out. And the MSA dollars are the amount that fills that gap so they can actually move to a less expensive, less restrictive alternative. And so it continues our efforts. It's in line with the Olmsted Court Decree that says, you know, we must, as a matter of public policy, serve people in the least restrictive environment. And with me to discuss sort of the county service system issues and their challenges is Commissioner Nancy Showalter from Dakota County. Chair Carr, members of the committee, I'm Nancy Showalter, Dakota County Commissioner, Chair of the County Board, and with my testimony today, I'm also representing MACSA. The additional Minnesota Supplemental Aid Special Needs Allowance for disabled individuals under the age of 65 assist them in affording housing, which also allows them the opportunity to integrate into the community upon release from a treatment center or nursing facility. However, our experience in Dakota County is that often these persons are still in need of 24-hour supervision and therefore are placed in corporate foster care settings using MA waiver funds. The Dakota County Board of Commissioners respectfully requests amending the statute to include licensed corporate foster care homes among the settings for which the additional Minnesota Supplemental Aid Needs Allowance is provided. This amendment will reduce the demand to use limited medical assistance waiver funds and facilitate the movement of these individuals from more costly institutions. Without this amendment, disabled individuals who are able to live without 24-hour supervision, they will continue to live in corporate foster care homes, expending limited MA waiver resources. In addition, others who are in more costly institutions will endure longer waiting periods before moving into community placements, adding an unnecessary burden to county costs for mental health commitments. This amendment will assure our disabled individuals will live in the most appropriate setting for their needs, the most cost-effective method, creating, therefore, a win-win situation for this population and for our taxpayers. I'd like to say on behalf of the County Board and NACSA that I thank you for your time and the consideration of this request.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions from Committee Members? Representative McNamara?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Loeffler and Commissioner. This is the kind of stuff I think we want to be doing, is getting people. My concern, Madam Chair, and I guess one question for you, Commissioner, we don't have a fiscal note, and I think we would want to have that because there may be savings that this committee or Representative Huntley's committee may be able to use in their target depending on the implementation dates, or there may be costs. And specifically, Commissioner, to you, is there cost to the county or savings to the county in this bill?
As I understand it, Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, what we end up doing is using the MA waiver in this situation, which is something that is limited in use, and we'd like to be able to save that for other more appropriate circumstances. But because without using that, then there is a cost to the county, as I understand it, that we end up having to come forward and supplement this difference so that we can have our clients in the most appropriate housing setting.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner Showalter, so you're saying that the bill would have savings for the county the way it is written?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, I think the motion is to refer it to finance. Would that allow for a fiscal note to
happen
in a timely fashion?
That's right, Representative McNamara. I think the advice is good to just seek that fiscal note. It's always good to know when there's savings and they can document that for you. That'd be good.
Madam Chair, I share your concern. The fiscal note process this year has, just because of our time frame, seems to have been backed up, and so you end up having to present bills without those, and that's why I shared the information that a Department of Human Services person had untold shared with the Senate, because it's going through a process, it just hasn't gotten here.
Okay, thank you. Representative Madore?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and testifiers. Actually, I would also like to encourage the committee to support this bill. Currently, we have 3,500 people under the age of 65 in nursing homes because we are unable to move them out into the community setting and into the least restricted environment. Unfortunately, we have other work to do, and that's a bill that you're going to hear us talk about called Options 2, which allows us to create housing options for people who are in these restricted nursing homes. We do have people at age 18, 19, 40 years old in a nursing home because they are unable to access community housing because of their full restrictions and their need for 24-hour care. So I would very much encourage the committee to support this bill and move it forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, if not, all those in favor of Representative Benson's motion that House Bill 3199 be recommended to pass and be referred to the committee. I'm sorry, I put the wrong one here. Return to the Committee of Finance. No further discussion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Let's see bills.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I know it's a full agenda
show. Thank you. Thank you. Next up, Powell is coming before us now, and I understand we have a new amendment.
Yeah.
We have a motion to move House File 3592.
nobody likes my bill.
Actually, I will move your bill if nothing else, Representative Tell. But I thought maybe one of my colleagues might want to.
I'd be happy to move
it. Representative Stumper wants to. I'm the honor. Okay.
Remove it. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'll move Representative Tell's bill.
Okay, and I believe the next motion would be to add, is it the A4 amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, the A4 amendment.
Okay, and then we should discard the A3 amendment if you have that in your... this replaces the A3 amendment. So you want to...
why don't we...
put this in the... This is, puts it in the form the author would prefer, is that
then
correct?
Then I would describe the bill.
Okay.
After,
yeah. All right. So the motion to adopt the A4 amendment to put the bill in the form the author would like is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those no. Motion prevails. And now we have...
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I know that we already moved the A4. I have an oral amendment.
Okay.
Well, it's already moved, so I'll. I got an oral amendment on the bill as amended.
Okay.
Essentially, on the A4, when you look at the A4 line 1.15, instead of may charge, we just want to strike that and change to shall charge.
1 point. What can you? Can you give me the line?
On the A4, please. On the A4.
Line.
1.15.
Oh, okay. In the
May. Change may to shall. Shall charge. There's a typo, so.
And do you want to change the word change to charge as well?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we can take that as an oral amendment. At this point, Commissioner, the language is to change on line 1.15. The Commissioner may change to, would be changed to the Commissioner shall charge. Is that correct? Also, okay, everybody understand the amendment? Okay, any further discussion? If not, the motion is before us. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Motion prevails, and now the bill is in the form the author would like to see. So please
thank you, Madam Chair and members. Right now, if you want to be a medical interpreter, you could just sign up with one of these agencies and then end up in the ER tomorrow without any prior training. And so because of the lack of, I guess, training, I mean, when you go through a lot of emergencies or medical situations, it's very important that the terminologies and situations are translated correctly. And so, right now, the state doesn't know, or we don't know, how many folks are out there and the level of training for these folks are out there. So, what this bill does is it starts with a voluntary roster to quantify how many medical interpreters we have out there, and then slowly move them into a registry, and eventually down the road look at certification to really get quality and to really make sure that we have qualified folks out there working interpreting in some of our more non-English speaking community. So, and the amendment we had essentially appropriated $25,000, but down the road a lot of these interpreters will end up paying for this registry or roster themselves through that fee. So we're not taking money out of anyone else's pocket, but they're paying for themselves.
Any discussion? Did you complete the discussion? Representative Swales, I believe, had a question?
Yes, I did. I do know that for people who are required to, or who take on jobs at hospitals, for instance, doing transcription of doctor's notes and so forth, they are required to go through special training at a Votech Center or some sort of an institution like that to become certified, because they need to know the prefixes, the suffixes, all of the the things pertaining to medical terminology. And I do see in here that you have a registry that you are wanting to create, but I really don't see, you talk about a national testing and certification process, but I don't really see where you are putting the coursework requirement, where these people would obtain that certification. Do you have any suggestions for that?
Representative Swell and members, when this bill goes into effect, it'll start out as a voluntary roster. And the stakeholders group, with the Professor Downing from the U, this group will work together to come up with the curriculum or requirements on what's needed to be certified. And so I think around that time that we'll probably have a bill to go into more detail on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Powell, how many interpreters now are known in the healthcare industry to be working and doing this type of activity?
Madam Chair and Representative Anderson, we don't know, and that's why this bill is needed to quantify that. Right now, through the state programs, we know that each year, I think we spend up to $15 million in interpreting services. With the private paying stuff, we don't know.
So, Madam Chair, President Chow, we pay $15 million for these interpretive services and we don't know who we're paying them to, or we don't know the number of people we
don't
to?
Know the number of interpreters out there.
Oh, boy, that's really bad.
And that's why we need this bill, Representative Anderson, to start that process and quantify those folks.
Madam Chair, Representative Powell, is the Commissioner in a full agreement with this? Have you talked with the Commissioner of Health, and are they... in agreement with this, and the fact that looks like it's going to cost them some money. Are they willing to fork over the money?
Representative Edison and Madam Chair, I believe this bill was worked through. We've been working with the Department of Health to come up with this language, as well as the MMA to come up with this language, and so there's been a lot of work to get to this point.
Mm-hmm.
With the amendment, essentially the money that will be put into this, I believe this roster will come from the fee that's collected from the interpreters who want to be on the roster. So.
Follow. Madam Chair, Representative Powell, do you know what the average cost is for an interpreter? Is there any type of documentation as to, we think it's $15 million, or at least that's what we know. Suppose it goes to interpreter. You know the average cost of what each session is with foreign interpreter that they have to have brought in?
I don't know the actual number, but it's up to each hospital to kind of, right now, there are two ways of doing it. Hospitals, providers could hire their own interpreters at what rate, whatever rate they negotiate at. And then the state programs such as UCARE could hire or contract out to agencies that will hire these interpreters. I know some interpreters myself, some are making anywhere from $15 to $30 an hour.
Representative Chow, is there a shortage of interpreters?
Madam Chair, President Anderson, I think it depends on your locality. You know, if you're in the rural area, I assume so. And the language that are spoken as well. I think a lot of this stuff will get hashed out with the study, with the stakeholders group to do more studies on this as well.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. just kind of a comment, really not a direct question to the author of the bill, although hopefully in the future he may come back with another bill to deal with this issue. My wife is in health care. The costs for interpreters, and we all know that they're absolutely essential to provide good health care, but the costs are escalating, and this is another mandate on health providers. And she tells the stories of interpreters coming to do the work, and many times the patients do not show up, and the health providers still must pay the interpreters this money. And we're talking especially for smaller health providing clinics, as well as I think general hospitals too, an enormous and increasing cost in this regard. And I think it's time the legislature in the near future really look into this issue, because it is a major cost push right now going on in the health profession. And it does not mean that we ought not to have interpreter services. It's just that it seems to be kind of willy-nilly and out of control, and another one of these mandates which I think we really need to look at much more carefully. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Swill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, our Representative Anderson was my hero here and did ask the question that I was looking at. It's the $15 million for interpreter services, with no roster, no way of really knowing who is receiving this amount of money, which hospital is spending the most. And I think that this is a good bill. I'm very supportive of it. I do know, I mean, some of our public schools have as many as 40 and 50 languages being spoken by children in the schools. I cannot imagine what it's like for their families to try to navigate healthcare without someone who can speak an appropriate language to help them. But I am very concerned about this accountability factor, and I hope that if your stakeholder group gets together, that it goes beyond creating a roster, but that it also looks at the funding mechanism so that these dollars are being used most efficiently. Thank you.
Representative Brown, and Madam Chair, the funding mechanism piece, originally it was part of this bill, but it was a little too hot, and so we'll have that discussion for a different day.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think I'm going to just challenge Representative Benson's. I know I normally would not do this, but I think we have to understand two things that are going on here. The need for the interpreter is because the individual often has the language barrier and is unable to get. But the other real significant part of the issue that's affecting what your wife is doing, the fact that most of these people do not have access to transportation. If they are relying on special transportation services that are not in Greater Minnesota in particular, you're dealing with volunteer service. We do not have metro mobility services through that where you can schedule rides in advance. Oftentimes they're required to pay a cab out of their pocket and be reimbursed. So for those families, even though the clinic may set up that appointment, oftentimes the families are locked in their homes because of transportation issues. So, and I also want to let the committee know that the payment of these interpreters, and that right now it's just on public programs, that our private pay insurers are not required to cover the cost of this, but our physicians, physicians are covering the cost of these interpreter systems. Right now we have no private pay insurer that will pay a private pay doctor. So that's all your free market insurance. They are passing this cost on to the physicians to cover because it's not reimbursable under their managed care contract right now. So let's be a little careful about the audience that we're talking about here. The people that are part of that are often restricted from having access to the $5,000 or $6,000 a year it costs to run an automobile in the state of Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Benson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, we do not actually disagree at all. All the problems that you just identified, of course, I agree with, and even my wife would in this case. I was simply suggesting it's time that the legislature look at this whole area, find out what the causes are for the problems, find some resolution to it, because this is another one of those cost drivers in the healthcare system. And I'm not casting aspersions on anyone, even those who don't show up for appointments, but there's a cost factor in all this, and we ought to be looking, you know, for savings wherever we can, and I'm sure Representative Madora more than agrees with that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I do. Thank you. Well, I think we're just about ready to vote, unless there's any other questions. Representative Semper.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question. Are providers mandated to provide interpretive services in the state of Minnesota? Is that a mandate?
Madam Chair, I believe that's a federal mandate.
I was just curious.
Did you get the answer to your question?
Yeah,
sorry, I was
thanks.
Okay. I just wanted to... Okay, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Powell, I think this is a good idea, what you're doing here. The one thing I would ask, Madam Chair, currently I know the court system, the counties, the Department of Human Services, MnDOT, DNR, all utilize interpreters in different times when they have needs for. And I'm not sure if we're not coordinating, and I think your idea here is a great one. I'm wondering, Representative Powell, if you thought about maybe what we should really be doing is asking all these departments, is there some kind of a system where they're keeping track of them and how they're utilizing them, how they're being paid, and some kind of a registry so we know their expertise? Because the medical field certainly is a specialized one where the interpreter may need to have some expertise. I'm wondering, Madam Chair, the motion was to move the bill, but it actually never said if it was to be laid over to or to be moved to the general register. What I'm wondering, Representative Powell, if the motion should be to lay over for possible inclusion, and maybe you could work on the language a little more with the chair to develop this idea, because I think you're positioned very well to be able to work on this.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, from the top of my head, I know that the court system has a roster, or they have, and there's some requirement to be on that roster as well. Other than that, I don't think we have put anything else. This is the first time, or the step in the right direction to go in that route. I do like to explore that idea down. But I think I would like to get a handle on this piece first, and we could certainly expand that in the future to include other groups. I think this bill is, to address the second part, I think this bill is supposed to go back to finance, and then from there it should end up in Health Human Service Finance. I think Representative Huntley's committee, and our intention is to if we need to work out more languages to amend it onto one of those finance bills. So.
Madam Chair, we might want to, I'm not sure we're ever clear on the motion.
Yeah,
the motion would be to move it to finance then, and it sounds like Representative Powell is on the same page.
Right, and I think that's
goal here.
I think that's right, that we'll move it back to finance, and it's probably going to go for inclusion in the omnibus bill, if I understand right. Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Powell, are there standards, is there criteria in place right now that interpreters have to abide by or work by in relationship to their job? And I know you're staying in here to set up a certification process and for the health department to do that, but how are they working now if they're not, they don't already have some kind of something in place?
Less than Anderson, there is no qualification or certification or any standard right now currently in Minnesota, and this will move into that direction this with this bill. I assume when we get the certification stuff, the standard will come back with a bill to do that through the scope of practice committee.
I might mention that this is an issue I've taken quite an interest in over the years, and that we do have some excellent resources at the University of Minnesota for the kind of training that people now rely on to look at in terms of standards. But this will formalize on that and make it more, develop it into a registry and so on. At least plan to do that. So there have been, you know, some train-the-trainers kind of opportunities that are available right now, but this will help us move us forward down that line so we really have points up with everyone, including rural. And I thank you for this, Bill, because I think it's very important. Representative Lane.
I have a question about the where it's going. Isn't this the deadline for finance committees? Could it be included in anything at this point? Could it be heard anywhere else at this point?
Representative Lane, it's alive, and the finance committee can take this bill. There's no problem for deadlines of finance committee. Okay. No further discussion, then I guess we're going to, thank you, because we'll move it to, for passage to be referred back to finance committee, and then from there we'll take its own note. Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the bill is on its way out. Members, I just wanted to share with you, information on our target, and, we did get these, and what you need to know is that this committee has the job of cutting $2.313 million from our budget, and that is the same as the governor has proposed. That's for year 08-09, and then it'll be double that in the out years. In other words, in the next 2 years, it'll be the same thing, extended 2 years, in 10 and 11. And it's our job, of course, to figure out how we want to do that. We're taking the governor's numbers, but we're not necessarily going to take his the places that he might want to make those cuts. And we will be talking next week about that and proposing. And I would like to have just extend an opportunity to meet with the Republican members of the committee about your thoughts on this. I've had a chance to do that with the Democratic members, and I'm very interested in what you may have to say. So
3:30.
I think it's today, isn't it?
Yep.
Let me check if that works. Okay. Does that work better, 3:30? Okay. 3:30 it is. And unless there's any further discussion. Oh, we have the minutes. I think Lane wanted to move these minutes, I know, for, is that correct? For Friday, March 14th. Any discussion? To approve the minutes, okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Most of the bills and the minutes are approved and adopted. And now the meeting will be adjourned. Thank you very much.